Good evening. I'll go ahead and call the July 21st Planning and Zoning Commission meeting to order. May I have a roll call, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Russell.
Here.
Mr. Tuohy. Ms. Burns.
Here.
I'm here. Mr. Harder.
Here.
Mr. McMahon.
Present.
Mr. Stanton. Mr. Strotman.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Rushing.
Here.
We have seven. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Secretary. Approval of agenda. Any changes to the agenda, Mr. Zinner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have had a request. I do have it formally submitted electronically. Unfortunately, it was received during our work session. For case number 16-137, that is the preliminary plat for Kitty Hawk Manor, plat number 6. They have requested that it be tabled, and I will read that tabling letter into the record. But that is the only change that we have to the agenda this evening.
Okay, so as we have done in the past, we would move that item to the front, and we're going to discuss it after we do our minutes. Okay, so
yes.
We'll make note of that, and we'll address it as soon as we get done with the approval of the minutes. So with that, everyone's had a chance to review the July 7th regular meeting notes. Are there any corrections, additions, modifications needed? I see none. Do we need a roll call for that? Yes. Thumbs up okay for roll call, for minutes? Everybody good on minutes? We're good? Everybody's good? Okay. We'll go ahead and move into the public. We're going to jump over to the subdivision section. We'll move it to the front. Case 16-137, request by Crockett Engineering Consultants on behalf of Manor Homes, LLC, for approval of an 8-lot preliminary plat to be known as Kitty Hawk Manor, plat number 6. The 3.80-acre subject site is generally located at the southwest corner of the Northland Drive and Parker Street. As Mr. Zinner mentioned earlier, there has been a tabling request. Was there a specific date, Mr. Zinner, of mind for that tabling yet, or do we know that?
That was to the August 18th agenda.
So moving that to the August 18th agenda item. As we have, is there anybody, since it was a published item on today's agenda, is there anyone from the audience that is here to speak on that specific item? If you are, you're welcome to come forward if you would like. As I see none, we'll close that part. Commissioners, any discussion, comments on tabling this matter to August 18th? We will need a roll call.
Yes, please. Mr. Chairman. So case 16, do we need a motion to move or motion to table?
Yes, please.
I'll make a motion to table case 16-137, a request by Crockett Engineering Consultants on behalf of Manor Homes for approval of an 8-lot preliminary plat, Kitty Hawk Manor, plat number 6. I'm finished. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mrs. Burns. And did we have a second, Mrs. Rushing? Ms. Rushing?
All right.
We have a roll call, please.
Yes. So case 16-137, Ms. Russell.
Yes.
Ms. Burns?
Yes.
I vote yes. Mr. Harder?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon?
Yes.
Mr. Strotman?
Yes.
Ms. Rushing?
Yes.
We have 7 votes for, none against. Motion carries.
So that item will be tabled. We'll now jump back a little bit to our public information and comment. Case 16-110, a request by the City of Columbia to adopt a unified development ordinance known as UDO, governing subdivision and land use regulations throughout the City of Columbia's corporate limits as requested by the City Council and supported by the City's 2013 comprehensive plan entitled Columbia Imagine, the plan for how we live and grow. The UDO will replace Chapter 25 subdivisions and Chapter 29 zoning of the City Code, as well as incorporate provisions from Chapter 12A, land disturbance, Chapter 20, planning, Chapter 23, signs, and Chapter and 24 streets, sidewalks, and public places into its contents. May we have a staff?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And as we have explained, we're holding our public information and comment session. This is the last of the 6 that were scheduled. This is going over Chapter 5 of the Unified Development ordinance, which is an enforcement and procedures, or I should say procedures and enforcement. As we have provided in every overview of the project, or every overview of these meetings, our project began in January of 2014 with the services of Clarion and Associates, our principal code consultant, and Farrell Madden, the subconsultant that is responsible for our MDT, or the replacement to our C2 zoning district downtown, our form-based code. Meetings that were held prior to these information sessions were between January of 2014 and November of 2015, and they were held in module format. Each of the modules basically dealt with a collection of similar topics, and we had four full public information sessions, the last being November 4th of 2015. At the November 4th, 2015 meeting, there was an integrated draft presented. That integrated draft incorporated all public comments made up to that point. That integrated draft was dated October of 2015. We are working on a version that is dated May 2016. The time period between October of 15 and May has been spent with staff reviewing the code contents, making revisions, and those revisions are what have been produced over the last six Planning and Zoning Commission information and comment sessions. This is not a public hearing. This is an opportunity for staff to explain code content and those that may be affected by the changes to speak to those concerns that they have for the purposes of ensuring that the final document that is produced for a public hearing, which would be held October 20th of this year, have been able to incorporate as many of the public comments and concerns that have been expressed. Topics that we're going to cover this evening, as I indicated, are procedures and enforcement. This is, while seemingly a very limited scope of information, as is always, it is not. This covers about 50-some-odd pages worth of code. I will try to go through this a little bit faster than I did at our last meeting. But we have, beginning our process here of Chapter 5, we're going to talk about procedures. And the procedures section of the code is broken basically into four general categories: reviewers and decision bodies, those that who are responsible for what and what decisions in the process, our standard procedures, the rules that apply to all applications or processes that come through community development or the Planning and Zoning Commission, Historic Preservation Commission, Board of Adjustment, and then our other departments that are allied with us as it relates to development issues. We have specific regulatory procedures, and those are the rules for very specific application processes, such as a rezoning or a floodplain development permit or a Board of Adjustment action for a variance or a conditional use. And then we have nonconformities. So the procedure section, again, is broken into these four broad categories. And the nonconformities, obviously, is how to use what doesn't meet our rules. So our reviewers and our decision-making bodies, we have in the new code a description of all of these bodies and their enabling legislation and what they're supposed to be doing and their roles within the development review process. Within the UDO, there are six categories or six groups that are specifically identified as shown here: Council, Planning Commission, Board of Adjustment, Historic Preservation Commission, the Community Development Department, which is what Chapter 20 is about and what our role is within the development process, and the director's role, and then our Public Works departments. And it is referred to as departments because we do have multiple pieces. And sometimes those pieces are not just maybe generally in Public Works. When the code was created, Public Works included certain other aspects such as stormwater. And stormwater is now a part of the Utilities Department. So we may have to make a couple of revisions to the code just to make sure that we're consistent with what the organizational structure is now. And we obviously identify those bodies or reviewing entities that are part of the development code process. Table 5.2-1, which is shown here, summarizes all of the actual actions that we have within the development code, and these are the specific regulatory processes, and it indicates what section of the code and basically what department is responsible for that, and then if you have an appeal or a decision-making role in it, That's defined by what is to the left of the, or to the right of the column called departments. So the Board of Adjustment, you appeal a zoning compliance denial to, or a building permit denial to. Certificates of occupancy, if you get denied on that, you'd appeal. A variance is a decision action of the Board of Adjustment. And you'll notice that there is an asterisk or a number one note there that subdivision design modifications, what we used to refer to as variances, are not handled by the Board of Adjustment. They are handled first by the Planning and Zoning Commission and then by City Council. And you can see the rest of, in this table, the rest of the decision-making bodies and what their role is, approval, decision, a recommendation. So that's how this table is structured, and it's structured as is a lot of our the tables within this code in order to help an individual user be able to identify who does what and when and under what circumstances and how long may they be in the process if they go to one body or another. Our standard procedures, and yes, that is a park bench. Our standard procedures basically include application materials and fees, talks about complete applications and are not processing or placing something into an agenda cycle until an application has been deemed complete. It talks about notice of hearings, and there are a variety of different types of notices that we produce. Published notice that's required under state law, for example, for rezoning actions or Board of Adjustment items. We have posted notice. We have mailed notice, and then we have electronic notice. These provisions within the new code clarify where we are obligated to do so and where we do so as a courtesy and what happens if we don't fulfill the actual written letters that are in the ordinance. Are we in violation of some notice procedure or hearing process? So that is how this section has been revised. It really is more reflective of the technologies that we are using and our desire to sometimes do more notice than is otherwise required, such as posting property, sending out a larger mailing list to people when we believe it is appropriate to do so. Those are the types of actions that now this revised section within the code deals with, and it also consolidates a variety of public notice procedures that existed as it related in other elements of the code that have been trying to be brought into one common location. We talk about decision making. Who has the right to make what decisions within the UDO in these standard procedures? Typically, it is the decision making process isn't any different than how it has always been. If it's an issue that the administrative staff can make, it's stated that way. If it's something that requires board, commission, council action, it stays the same. There's very little variation here, maybe some tweaking and some clarification of particular points, but the general position of who makes what decisions at what levels within the approval process isn't really changing any. We're not making any significant changes. Conditions on approvals. This particular section clarifies that the Board of Adjustment has the authority to condition approvals. While that would seem to be a no-brainer, maybe, it wasn't clearly pointed out within the current code. So Clarion and their revamping of our structure said we needed to clarify that because that's actually a role of the board. They can apply conditions on approvals. Council can apply conditions, and the Planning Commission can apply additions. So we basically are maintaining, again, a very similar flavor to what we have had previously, but again, in a slightly restructured format. Modification of approvals. And if you have read the draft that was released or the public has read the draft, it identifies this section as being entirely eliminated. It dealt with a major and a minor revision process. As the sidebar note indicated, there was a concern that allowing administrative staff the ability to modify a council approval or a Board of Adjustment approval may not necessarily be in compliance with state statute. We do not typically disagree with that at a staff level, and it was made request to have it removed by the law department. However, we have also suggested within that sidebar note that that particular section potentially be restructured to deal specifically with plan district amendments in a minor or a major situation. What I will tell you as going through and preparing for this meeting this evening, we have those provisions for minor and major amendments within the PD approval section. Therefore, this particular section may not necessarily be needed if we are going to agree with the position that our law department has provided, that administrative staff are not authorized to override a council decision. But we can come back and we can discuss that as we finalize the document. And then we have the appeals process. Anybody can appeal anything that we deny. Typically that goes to the Board of Adjustment if it's a zoning-related item. And in certain instances, even if it is not a zoning-related item, the Board of Adjustment can be assigned additional duties to take care of denials, for example, of certain types of platting actions, to have them resolve them instead of them going to City Council. Which would be where you would think if the Board of Adjustment doesn't deal with something, it may go to council because they are a decision-making, they are a final decision-making body, and the Board of Adjustment is quasi-judicial in its establishment and its procedural requirements. Therefore, it has final decision-making authority as well. The Commission, sorry, you're a recommending body, so we can't take appeals to you generally. Though the public will come and appeal to you every once in a while when, you know, my staff is not being very cooperative, which hopefully doesn't happen frequently. So moving into the fourth topic area here, it is our specific third topic area, the specific regulatory procedures. This is probably one of our larger sections, if not the largest section within Chapter 5, and this goes through the requirements for each process type. We have a whole slew of application types, and we have a whole slew of activity that we deal with that is regulated at some level by the code's content. So this particular section of Chapter 5 deals with those very specific regulatory requirements. If you recall, when I was presenting the subdivision standards, we never covered what the subdivision requirements were. So we've separated what the standards are for a submission on a subdivision plat, what it takes to make a subdivision plat good enough. Now what we're going to tell you is what it takes to get it processed through the application process to get it approved. Well, that's how this section and this particular category of the UDO works. It's not the specific regulations that are how good it has to be. This is how we process. And all of those processing requirements are in this one general location for all of our application types. So here we begin, and I will go through and touch on every single application type that we have within this particular section, but I will not go into great detail on any of them. I have highlighted a couple of things that are unique. So the first application type or process type we have is zoning compliance. The second is building permits. And one of the major changes that we have made in this proposed UDO, and we have said this previously, is that there will no longer be the ability to build over a property line for adjoining properties in order to have them considered a single lot for the purposes of building. We will be requiring that if you want to build over a property line in the new UDO, you will be replatting that land into a single development site. It modernizes the platting that exists within the public records. And it also provides an opportunity for the city, in certain instances, if we are in need of utility easements, right-of-way, or other things that are necessary for the public welfare, we are able to get them at that point. It also addresses some other unique issues that we occasionally get into about lots being avoiding having to go through a platting and a public process in order to unlock additional densities, possibly with lots. And that occurs more frequently potentially in East Campus as well as in the Ben Stevens neighborhoods where we have overlays that restrict density because of lot sizes. But if you combine lots, you have the ability then to be able to work under the new regulations because you can follow the existing standards. So the planning process provides an opportunity for that to become more transparent, word of the day. We have certificates of occupancy are addressed within this particular section as well. Variances, as I had indicated, most variances will go to the BOA except for subdivisions, historic overlay variances, and stormwater regulations on a limited basis. Some stormwater regulation variances are actually capable of being approved by the Public Works Director. That is currently in the code, and that is currently part of the regulatory process that we're moving forward. Adjustments to form-based controls. This is a section that is also, or this is a new section that has been created, obviously, as a part of the form-based controls. It includes criteria that constitutes minor revisions, to the form-based controls, and then major revisions. Minor revisions are administered by and approved by the director of community development, whereas major revisions are approved by the Board of Adjustment. So there are certain thresholds that the community development director cannot exceed with a modification to our design requirements in the form-based code, generally anywhere in between 5 to maybe 10% in particular areas. And anything beyond that goes through the Board of Adjustment process. It's more of a public hearing process, and it must meet two general criteria at the very beginning of the minor amendment section, one of which indicating that it's not going to have – it creates superior – the proposed variance would create superior design or allow for something else to occur that is equal, and that it does not undermine any other regulations, if I recall correctly. Moving on, land disturbance permitting. These are content requirements that come out of Chapter 12A, Article 2, with some wording that's been revised for the purposes of clarity. Stormwater permits is the same, Chapter 12A, Sections 92 through 94, with minor revisions. So these are areas that we are not changing at all, but we're bringing over so people can understand what the general regulatory framework is for being able to obtain those permits. Optional development standards. And this is BOA approval, and this deals with our new provisions that we have created to create options in the R2 zoning district for cottage development, in the MN district for pedestrian development, and in the MC district for transit development. There was a great discussion as these provisions were being created as to how do they get established. Does it have to go through a rezoning action? And Clarion's position was, if you're going to have to go through a rezoning action, you're basically creating a new zoning district. It's inefficient. So we went back and forth, and what was finally agreed upon by Clarion and our legal staff was a Board of Adjustment process that has criteria associated with it. Staff produces a report that analyzes a variety of factors. The Board of Adjustment takes action on it. That board action is recorded at the courthouse, just like any other ordinance would be if it was approved by the council as a rezoning action, and then those standards are applied to that property. If a property owner should choose at some point then to want to go back to the original standard, not cottage, for example, but regular R2, or they wanted to go back to the standard MN or standard MC zoning setbacks and other restrictions, they basically reverse the process but going through the same steps. They'd go back through the Board of Adjustment to do so. And that may be because the property sells over time and maybe the pedestrian development idea didn't work. They want to redevelop the land, but they want to develop it conventionally. They don't want to develop it closer to the street. So that's why that provision exists, for it to be reversed. It's not a permanent, not unlike any other zoning classification. You can always come back in and ask for it to be changed. And you can always change it back. But again, the Board of Adjustment affords a public hearing process, and it affords an opportunity for us to basically have the board handle one of those other assigned tasks other than what a variance would be. So we created those standards, and they're embedded here within this specific regulatory process. So if you're looking at the permitted use table and you're wondering, well, how do we establish cottage-style lots, go here. You'll find what you need to know. Conditional use permits. This is, as we've talked about previously in work session, and I believe I have made comment on previously, these will become a item of the Planning Commission. These are currently an item of the Board of Adjustment. The Commission will be making recommendation, and it is a very lengthy process as to how this operates, but you will be making recommendation. It then goes to make a recommendation at one meeting. We bring you back what would be a board order. We, in essence, then would produce that. It would be forwarded to City Council. City Council can review that. They can make modifications to it, and the council ultimately has the approval authority. As I have said previously, we will go back through the conditional use list. It will likely not be before we complete the UDO, but we will go back, and we will be hopefully carving out conditional uses and making certain conditional uses permitted uses or permitted uses subject to standards in order to avoid unnecessary delays to particular items that really are not generally politically sensitive if they're treated properly through buffering and screening and other methods. We just have not – that was not part of Clarion's charge. And it has not been a priority of staff at this point in order to be able to go back and identify all of those. Conditional uses are relatively far and few in between right now. They apply for telecommunication towers. They apply for residential pools in subdivisions and a few other items. So we don't see many of them before the Board of Adjustment, and it's not a it's not an issue where we're going to create significant upheaval if we delay working through the use table to identify conditional uses that may need to come out and develop then corresponding specific use standards for them. We have adjustments to the form-based controls. As I had indicated, those fall into two general categories, minor and major. We have sign permit provisions. These have been suggested that they are substantive requirements and they may need to be brought back into the sign code section of the ordinance, which we covered at the June or July 7th meeting. And these are basically verbatim. They come out of section chapter 23 of the city code, which is the sign ordinance, sections 4 through 10, with some minor wording clarifications. In the same manner or in the same light, we have a sign plan approval process, which does come out of the sign code as well, and that's section 9. It is a more it is not necessarily suggested to be removed, I think, from this particular procedure, because it is a plan approval process, and therefore it would remain here in the specific regulatory procedure section, but it again is verbatim with some minor wording tweaks and clarifications. We have temporary parking standards. This is a very innocuous section within these specific regulatory procedures. It is at the recommendation of our law department, as noted in the side margin, that these particular paragraphs be moved back into the actual parking ordinance to where you would probably figure out, if you were reading it, well, when can I have temporary parking and what's my process for it? If we put it in as a heading in the regular parking requirements, which is 29-4.4, it may make more sense. So we will likely be doing that in the update for the final public hearing draft. Floodplain development permit requirements, these are identical to what currently exists within the code. And they are actually just a verbatim notation of that. Our subdivision process, and I will explain more of this because this is somewhat significant in some of the changes that have been made. Our subdivision processes are, in many respects, maintaining a lot of its same character, but we've had to correct a number of omissions and some very confusing language at times. One of those areas is our small area transfer provision, which is an exempt activity right now. There is nothing within the code that defines what a small area transfer is, and it has always perplexed our staff as to how small. So what we have created in this UDO is an actual clarification of that. It's an area no greater than 3% of a sending or a receiving parcel. So you have a 1,000-square-foot parcel, you're only going to be able to transfer 300 square feet either from your property to your adjoining lot or from the adjoining lot to the receiving lot. That's basically what it is, and my math is probably wrong there. But nonetheless, it's 30 feet or 30 square feet. So common lots, another big issue that we have in transfers by small parcel transfer or exempt transaction are another area. You cannot, under the proposed UDO and the revisions, transfer common lots that have been identified, platted, or ground. They are not eligible for a small area transfer. You have to go through a formal platting action on that. It is becoming more and more of a concern of staffs that common lots are being hacked away at after they are identified on preliminary plats or final platted property because a property owner wants more land and therefore, you know, the developer decides, well, I want to be able to sell my lot and build a home, but he wants that piece of common lot, so we're going to go ahead and sell him the common lot too. We have a strong belief as a staff that what's presented to the Planning Commission as a common lot and then what's approved by council as a common lot should remain a common lot. unless you come back through a more formal process to eliminate that common lot. So there is, again, transparency in what you're marketing. Transfers, small area transfers, are only permitted on platted property. They will not be permitted if you have only shown preliminarily platted lots. We will not allow you to transfer area without having it been final platted. We have the subdivisions, subdivision approval now is tied to compliance not only with the UDO's requirements, which one would expect. However, it has also been reinforced that a subdivision plat needs to be compliant with the goals and the objectives generally of the UDO. So that is something that we have added in, as well as our comprehensive plan, I apologize, and other ordinances that we may have. There are other ordinances that may exist or may be adopted at a later date that a subdivision plat needs to basically comply with. And so the comprehensive plan is a pretty broad document. We've heard that before. It incorporates a lot of references to all of our other plans, such as transportation and stormwater and some other things. And this particular idea is to make sure that we can effectuate the comprehensive plan and its objectives. As I had indicated earlier, the variance criteria that currently exists within our subdivision regulations is being retitled. It will become design modifications in the UDO, and design modifications or design adjustments will no longer be based on hardship criteria. The standard hardship criteria that we have used historically is being replaced by more design-related or design alternative options. It's very difficult to claim that you have a hardship if you're dividing your property up for the first time, and how it's so much more unique than anybody else. So there is the opportunity still, though, to ask for a design modification from one of our basic UDO standards. And where I see this maybe potentially being used is as it relates to our cul-de-sac maximum length of 750 feet, which is proposed. We may have certain conditions in where 750 feet just isn't long enough to be able to get you past a ravine following a ridge line or something along those lines, or to where you can economically put in a cross street at a break point to avoid that. So I see it being used more in that respect. And as we've talked about, sidewalk variances or sidewalk design modifications now will fall into this general category possibly, along with the craziness of our sidewalk construction and installation requirements that we had talked about previously. Adjustments. Why am I going the wrong way here? I want to get through this presentation. Okay, so we have the plat approval process. Very similar to how we currently have our plat approval process, but we've basically, with each of these processes, we've also identified a flow chart. So what I'm trying to explain here is our minor subdivision process has a concept review and a final plat associated with it. If you have a major plat, anything that's five lots or greater, or includes public infrastructure, you're going to have you'll have a concept review, but you'll have a preliminary plat and a final plat in order to be able to get a final lot approved for development and sale. We have an administrative platting process, which is a select category of particular types of development activity, and that only goes through an admin platting procedure. Generally reserved for lots that already exist and that have already gone through a final platting process and that meet very specific requirements. Not unlike what we have today, a plan development district plan serves as the preliminary plat. They are approved concurrently in the new UDO. And you will notice that the application criteria that currently is in Chapter 25 for all of our processes has been removed. It will be in that elusive administrative manual that I keep telling you that we will be generating, which we will have here. The preliminary plat approval process has changed significantly, I will say that. We have talked about this previously as well. Currently, 45 days is the timing associated with having to render a decision on that. It is being changed to 60. That is consistent with the state statute. So we had reduced our time frame less than what the state allowed us, so we're extending it to what the maximum of the state is. We have changed the 7-year preliminary plat approval to a 3-year time frame now. And we have added or revised a condition that basically states that every final plat that is submitted, if it is not final plat at all at once, each of the subsequent final plats must meet new technical or engineering requirements that are adopted after the date of the preliminary plat. Purpose behind that, it was never clear enoughly stated, in my opinion, within our current code, to make that clear, that you are always required to meet the most current standard. I think in practice, we normally didn't have individuals not following through with that, but we wanted to make clear each new final plat, if it's not all approved at once, because you have to submit construction plans to get a final plat approved, and if you only submit a phase of a larger project, it's very possible between building that first phase and building your second phase and submitting those construction plans, our regulations may change. We don't want somebody being able to claim, well, I want the old regulations that had inferior construction requirements associated with them. We change our regulations for a reason, and it's normally to ensure that we have better quality development. And this particular provision will allow that. The time frame difference as well, we believe, will potentially reduce the scale of particular plats to where we're platting large acreages all at once. We come in and we try to basically get a preliminary plat on 100 acres, but we know because the market is very slow, we won't see all of that developed but for 10 years. We believe that this may create a little bit of pause from a developer perspective, that maybe we want to take things that we can manage, we can bite off more easily instead of losing our preliminary plat approval. This is not, this makes very clear as well, it's irrespective if you record a final plat, you're not going to get the extension. You don't get 3 years from the date of every final plat. It's 3 years from the date of preliminary plat approval at council. It's not 3 years extended. And that's, we've had situations in where under our current system, it basically allowed you, if you recorded a phase of a large project, within 7 years, your entire preliminary plat was locked in perpetuity. That's not how these regulations now read. Text and map amendments. This is basically text changes that we make as or zoning map amendments. The PZs, the Planning and Zoning Commission now has the authority to make application. That has been added to this language. Review and response times for internal comments and applicant comments coming back to the staff has been revised to be consistent with our current practices, which went from 15 days to 10. We've operated on that for the 8 years that I've been here, so we thought maybe high time to get the code right. And then we have the application material again is no longer in the code. It will be in the administrative manual. And those are really the major changes here. Everything else is pretty well the same. We have carved out of the map amendments section of the current code the planned district requirements, and we have done so because we have consolidated all of our planned district zoning standards into a single PD district now. So instead of having the four, we have just one. It follows one set standard procedure in establishing any planned zone. And it requires in the new UDO that along with your request to rezone and your statement of intent, you have to have a development plan. It is no longer an option under the UDO as it's proposed that you can come in and do the two-step process that we currently have where you can seek zoning entitlement and then come in at some later date with a development plan. The concept behind this is if you have such a unique project, you should have a user in tow that needs the zoning right then and there. Otherwise, we have a zoning district most likely within our lineup that should fit your needs. Or you may be able to seek some type of variance from our Board of Adjustment as to some aspect of our code that you can't comply with. We really would desire to have development plans that are for real projects, not some phantom project that may or may not occur and is being used potentially as a ruse to be able to obtain some intensification of the zoning with no intention of ever developing. The plan, again, is valid only for a period of 3 years. It has the option for a single one-year extension at the discretion of council. And minor PD modification criteria has been, is minor and major criteria are there. The minor PD criteria for making amendments is basically applying to residential and non-residential plan districts, though. So we have that specific carve-out for how amendments to a plan district that can administratively be made are actually processed. They're related to residential and non-residential standards. That's an addition to what we currently have, which allows you to make other modifications to commercial or office projects. We have included within the code a reference to all of the map amendment processes for our other overlay zones, such as our urban conservation, our scenic road district. Does follow the standards for any rezoning action. It's the same public hearing process. It would come back through the Planning Commission with exceptions that are basically integrated into the actual individual overlays themselves. And the second overlay, the SRO, should read that there are embedded procedural variations. And it would be to the SRO, not the UC. So we have a particular process unique to our residential mobile home park district. It functions very similar to a plan district, and it has a plan. It has very specific plan criteria. The sidebar merge and note within the draft that is out for Chapter 5 suggests that we may not need the RMH zoning district process. Mr. Molman and I have had a conversation as it relates to that. We have some concern that eliminating that process may create a whole slew of nonconformities for existing mobile home parks that we have, or create some additional unknown burden upon those mobile home parks in order to become compliant with the PD. And we feel that while it seems redundant, mobile home park creation is very limited. It sometimes has value if we're annexing in mobile home parks from the county, and therefore leaving these standards here specify the requirements by which any mobile home park that's coming into the city would need to meet maybe design requirements for plan preparation and identification of site improvements as a minimum, and then any new mobile home park that would be developed inside the city has to meet these particular standards. The one interesting aspect associated to this is a mobile home, or I should say a manufactured home, is a principal permitted use in our R1 zoning district. We do not view them any differently than a site-built single-family house. A mobile home, an RMH district, however, allows for a much smaller lot. It allows for a different type of street network, and it allows for a whole variety of other things that you do not see in a standard subdivision. And therefore, it's a little bit more challenging to just say we can eliminate the zoning district, call it a plan district, but our plan district has to meet all of our subdivision requirements. So leaving this particular district as it's set up with its unique aspects associated to it of relief for this particular style of housing is probably in the best interest of the community just for an inclusive nature of housing options, instead of trying to create something that may ultimately end up with a higher development cost because of having to meet additional regulatory standards. So we have created or added a section that specifically in the specific regulatory procedures that talks about the comprehensive plan and how the comprehensive plan is amended. These are procedures that are embedded, in essence, in the back of our comprehensive plan in the implementation chapter. It was placed here in the code in order to identify for the public what that process would be. Any amendment to the comp plan is going to function like almost a zoning text change because it is a document that has to be run through the commission as part of a public hearing process. And ultimately that then results in a recommendation on changes to the plan that is approved by City Council. So this is really more of just, again, including a piece in the regulatory structure so people know if I want to propose an amendment to the comp plan, what does it have to go through when I'm looking at the actual development code itself. You as an applicant may choose, may believe you don't want to do something that's in the comp plan and you may want to make an amendment to it, is the scenario that I would see potentially occurring. So nonconformities. You know, we're all a zebra of a different color, but at least we've all agreed that I can be at peace with myself because of it. The non-conforming section, never mind, that didn't go over well. The non-conforming section, the non-conformity section includes generally five topic areas. We talk about uses, which deal with both land and buildings. So this would be a non-conformity, a non-conforming use of a land, could be outside of a building, or the non-conforming use of a building. We have non-conforming structures, different from building, and then you have lots, non-conforming site features, and we have non-conforming signs. Now, those are the five general categories. So, you know, if you want to stand out in the crowd, just be a different color or be gold. And so, in essence, you have, for non-conforming uses, basically the non-conforming standards are pretty generic. They follow a lot of what we already do. Land uses or buildings, once they become non-conforming or they were annexed in as a non-conformity, they cannot be expanded. That's pretty standard fare. A use, however, a non-conforming use can be expanded up to 25% provided it is in a conforming building upon BOA approval. And this is a clarification to how the current code is written. This apparently always existed, but it was never clear. So what we have done is we've broken non-conforming uses into one section, and we've broken non-conforming structures into another in the new UDO. And this particular provision deals with how you can expand a non-conforming use within a conforming building. But you have to go through the board to do so. And it is only allowed to be expanded up to that 25%. A use or a building can be changed between non-conforming uses, provided that they have fewer impacts. So the prime example of this that we use is the Diggett building. And for the life of me, I cannot remember the Great Hang-Ups building that's on the corner of Broadway and Garth. West. Thank you. Is now Diggett, the print shop. That went through a process initially of our identifying that there was a whole series of uses that we could go from Great Hang-Ups to that were considered consistent nonconformities but of no greater impact. So what this particular provision is doing for you is it's basically saying you could change that building to a nonconforming use to allow the building to continue to be used as long as that impact is no greater. And the original nonconformity that was exited out of the building can't come back in to be reestablished. This clarifies that particular question that has occasionally come up. If you change a land use, a nonconforming land use or a nonconforming building to a conforming use, you can't go backwards. It's once conforming, always conforming. So you cannot go back to a nonconformity. And then discontinuance, for whatever purpose, you choose to stop doing your business, you have an act of God, or it burns down, or there's a natural disaster, or the public enemy comes and takes it out for you, and it's more than 6 months before you decide to rebuild, reestablish that business, the nonconformity is no longer permitted, and the building must be brought to conforming status. This is a change from 12 months to 6. The 12 months seemed to be excessive in our mind as a staff, and we felt that 6 months was more than ample time if you have natural disaster potentially to have the building reconstructed in accordance to the procedures that existed. The public and the commission may disagree with us on that, but we're also trying to look at how do we move things along when they are maybe non-conforming or they've just been abandoned. And I will apologize. I'm going to have to go out of the actual view here. Given the way that I was in the process of trying to prepare the presentation, the last couple of slides did not get entered into the presentation. Nonconforming structures, another one of our sections. Again, you can expand a use provided that it meets all of our regulatory requirements. So if you have a structure that is on your property that is currently nonconforming because it was either too close to the property line and it's existed, and you want to add on to that building, you can add on to that nonconformity as long as your add-on is not in the nonconforming area. It complies with all of our requirements, i.e., if you were got a 10-foot front yard setback or a 10-foot setback on your front yard and you want to add something on the front of the building, it would have to be set back 25 feet. Now, if you can't do that, you could come to the BOA to grant a variance if necessary, arguing some hardship. But that is how the code reads, that's one of those areas that is clarified between use and expanding a use within a nonconforming building and then actually expanding that nonconforming building. The only way you can expand it is you got to meet our standards that exist today. You can't unless the board grants you otherwise. And a nonconforming use, as I've said before, can be expanded 25% into the addition of the nonconforming building, provided it's conforming. That's, you know, you're building this addition onto your nonconforming building. You could go to the board and you could ask to expand your nonconforming use into the expansion area, but it is limited up to the 25%. And then our damage and destruction criteria for structures, which is 75% of its reasonable value, that still exists. That is unchanged from how it currently reads in the current code as it relates to structure loss for damage and destruction. Lots. This is a new general area, I think, that it has existed. But nonconforming lots, normally you would think that you'd have to go through some type of planning process in order to make them conforming. Many of you may be aware that the code does include particular criteria that says that no lot that existed prior to the adoption of the code that is less than the required area is not restricted from development for anything other than a single-family home, provided it's a minimum of 5,000 square feet and it has 60 feet of frontage. That provision exists within our residential zoning districts. This particular section of nonconformities, from our interpretation, Mr. Molman's and my interpretation, actually creates a way out that that particular restriction, nothing less than 5,000 square feet and not having less than 60 feet of frontage, is gone. And so if you have a lot that's 4,500 square feet that's existing and has less than 60 feet of roadway frontage, and you can meet all of the required setback requirements and anything else of the zoning district in which that lot is located, and you want to put a structure on it, you have the ability to do so without having to potentially go through a variance process or have the property replatted and combined with other land. It's a way of using potentially some of our remnant and smaller parcels that we have within the more urban area of the city. It is unlikely that this would be seen anywhere in our more suburban environments, given the fact that those lots generally are more conforming to a standard. This application as well may be very restricted because of the way that we refer to lot access needing to be obtained to make a lot legal. It's very critical that when folks look at this, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's got a lot of strings attached with it. You have to meet all of the other regulatory requirements, which is inclusive of setbacks, inclusive of height restriction, inclusive of access. And we don't waive any of that. What is confusing with this section, and it took Mr. Molman to explain to me why he was confused, because he originally said we don't need it. It's circular in nature, and I put it in. Is it fails to tell you what the lot that exists is nonconforming in respect to. So we will have to add in the version that is put forth for the public hearing that it is nonconforming as in respect to lot area and frontage. Once you specify that, the provision makes a little bit more sense. So that would be how we would basically address it. So if you have anything less than the required lot frontage or lot area for the district in which that lot is located, if you can meet all of the other standards, you can develop. And that may be a high bar to have to hurdle. But again, it does open up an opportunity and an avenue that doesn't exist today, because in essence, anything less than 5,000 or 60 feet is not developable by our code. You have to do something with it other than structural improvement. Nonconformities, moving on, site features. And this is generally dealing with parking and loading, landscaping and screening, and then lighting. You can expand a use on a site that has these nonconformities, provided that that expansion or that use or structure is allowed in the zoning district. So if you're a nonconforming building in a zoning district and you have on top of that nonconforming site features, you can expand your nonconforming building without bringing the site into compliance. The second criteria, or that second bullet is the expansion doesn't increase the level of nonconformity in any respect to the landscaping, parking, or lighting. That may be, again, a high bar to have to come over. Your additional parking, if you can meet the first two criteria, has to be provided on site. You cannot basically park it off-site somewhere else. And as we've talked about before, small area or small lot exceptions come into play. So a lot that may be less than 10,000 square feet, not within 100 feet, front property line, not within 100 feet of residential, you may not have a parking requirement. So there's a caveat to that. You may not, if you want to provide parking, but you want to do it off-site and your site doesn't require it, you likely can provide it off-site because you're not regulatorily required to have any. And then if you do any partial reconstruction or construct a new structure on the property, you're required to bring the site into full compliance. That's basically, we don't want brand new development to occur or substantial reconstruction or any type of reconstruction to basically commence and you leave the site in its non-conforming status. So that is how the site features non-conformity section works. And then the signs, we have a lot of provisions that deal with non-conforming signs. And most of these are, not most, all, are in Chapter 23. So we are going to, these are the same sign code non-conformity provisions that exist. You'll notice within the online draft a number of the items that are date-driven with expired dates have been proposed to be removed because they are no longer relevant. We have a couple of sections within the code that talked about signs in the downtown district constructed prior to 1956, which is the Tiger sign, and then wall, awning, and canopy signs, if I recall correctly, is the other provision that is shown being deleted that offers particular provisions or protections to the general nonconforming language that is within this particular section. If a sign becomes 60% damaged or in disrepair, which is what the first provision of this particular section reads, that sign has to become compliant. The two provisions that we removed at the very end of this particular nonconforming section gave protection for that level, that threshold. In essence, they allow for, if your sign or you're refacing a sign that's a legal nonconformity in the CBD, if it's a wall sign, for example, and it was a legal nonconformity and it had deteriorated to the point of more than 60%, the exception that was already in the code that we proposed to eliminate would allow you to replace that nonconforming sign face without having to take the sign off. Likewise, the provisions that exist for signs, nonconforming signs that existed prior to 1956 gives the same protection. So after we had looked at that a little bit more thoroughly, after the draft was produced for this meeting, we concluded, no, those two provisions do need to come back into the code because they basically provide additional protection from the standard 60% that would apply to any other nonconforming sign outside of the central business district, the downtown. And that is that was a carved out particular exception to the general provision. We believe that it's important that it does maintain itself within the code. And finally, in the last section, and I will let Mr. Molman speak to the enforcement provisions. We had some real interesting photographs that Mr. Molman wanted me to put in as the graphics, an outhouse next to a residential home, and a lean-to. I said I needed to keep the quality of the presentation intact. And have only left him with this boring graphic for him to speak from. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Molman for this evening's enforcement provisions.
Thank you, Pat. So anyone that's had any experience with the enforcement end of the zoning or subdivision or sign code or any of the UDO's constituent parts is going to find what they find in the violations enforcement and penalty sections to be very familiar. Not much is being changed. Some clarifications, wordsmithing, but the no intent to really change any substantive requirements or or actions in this section. So these sections cover, you know, violations, what actions constitute violations of the code, enforcement, what actions can the city take to address these violations, and penalties, what penalties will accrue to people that commit such violations. So the violations sections are like I said, very similar to what has been in the previous code and just compiled in one place. I will say that there's one section in particular relating to temporary parking on residential yards that is included within this draft. However, I think we've determined that maybe some further study is needed to make sure that we're not creating a loophole where there could be an endless loop of violation notice and no ultimate resolution of a case. The current code treats parking on residential yards in a different manner than a lot of other violations. We want to make sure that the fairness and that is contemplated within the current code is carried forward, but is done so in a way that makes sense, that it cannot be abused. excuse me. Enforcement section is once again very similar. There's not much different than what's contained in the current code. It outlines the activities that the Director of Community Development and the Director of Public Works can take in addressing violations, and gives a pretty broad menu of the actions that they can take in order to address violations of either the zoning sections, the subdivision sections, or other sections of the code. If anyone has any particular questions, I'm happy to answer on those, but I'm going to kind of skip through those because they're fairly insular in each of their impacts. Violations, once again, carrying forward what we're already doing. Violations are set up in basically a three-tier system. A penalty for a first offense of no more than $250, that is below what we are statutory authorized to assess for first violations. $500 for second and subsequent violations, so an escalating fee schedule for subsequent violations, and then also an ability to assess penalties for failure to address violations. So continuing violations has a means to address those situations as well. Special penalties outline penalties that we can impose under alternative state statute. Subdivision standards has some additional state statute contains some additional abilities to assess fines for certain types of violations of the subdivision standards. So the special penalties outline those. Excuse me. Special penalties also include violations of the stormwater and natural resources. The City Council has previously determined that those types of violations should be dealt with in the same manner as Class A misdemeanors under Chapter 16, which is the general violations chapter of the code. And so we're going to treat those types of violations with a little bit more seriousness. A little bit higher possibility for fines. And then sign standards is also outlined. Generally, those are not taken care of with the $250 fine, but a lower $100 fine. And then once again, temporary parking in yards, that is a lower lower penalty at $100 per violation. That gets us through that particular section.
So, we've wrapped up again another installment of the staff reporting for the final chapter of the UDO, which is Chapter 5. And what do we have left? Well, obviously we've got to do a final draft of the document as we have presented it, and that is what we, the staff, as well as the commission, will be working on between now and the early portion of September. We intend on having a final draft, the public hearing final draft, released on or about September 23rd. As many are aware, the Commission had requested an extension of the Planning Commission's public hearing date, and that was heard by Council this past Monday. Council did agree that an extension was appropriate, and they have authorized the Commission to proceed forward with an October 20th public hearing date. So that is no longer tentative. That is a firm public hearing date. We will have a draft released, and we will be having a hearing in that order on the dates of September 23rd for the draft and then October 20th, roughly a month between, to allow the public to review that final draft. And then Council's introduction of the code, we would be proposing that it be introduced no later than November 21st. It is possible that, depending on the outcome of the public hearing, that Council could receive the document at its first November meeting. However, as a standard practice for any public hearing item that is processed through the Commission, there is generally a one Council meeting cycle delay. That is to allow staff to prepare the appropriate paperwork and reports that are necessary to have items placed on the agenda. So I will not be surprised if we meet the November 21st deadline generally as the preferred option. But that is where we have left to go at this point. Staff is continuing to upload the comment and issue spreadsheet as it is updated to the city's website. And that, along with all of the code chapters that we have gone over, all of the PowerPoint presentations that we have made, the revised MDT map that was presented at the July 7th meeting. All of that material is out on our community development portion or page of the city's website. It is underneath the Development Code Update Project heading under New and Noteworthy, and you can get all of the information that we have presented to the Commission and the PowerPoints and the reports, all of our staff reporting from this particular location. The spreadsheet has been uploaded. It is current as of today, including all comments with sectional references and responses through the June 23rd Planning and Zoning Commission meeting. All PowerPoint presentations through the July 7th meeting have been uploaded, and this presentation will be uploaded either tomorrow or early next week. So that is all we have for this evening as it relates to the code from our perspective. If there are any comments or questions of the Commission specifically, Mr. Molman or I can answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner and Mr. Moran, for those presentations. Commissioners, is there any questions for staff? Yes, Mr. Macklin.
Yeah, Mr. Zinner, as you were speaking about nonconformities, transitions, changes, it's still pretty broad, and I'm running through, I live on the west side, and I'm downtown all the time. I notice Ms. Essing was also paying a lot of attention because both of us deal with nonconformities. There are lots that are bizarre. I'm looking forward to you adding those detailed pieces. And I'm just wondering, and forgive me because I wasn't on the commission, that when we tested, I know this is a kind of a strange question, did we test any nonconforming things?
I don't believe we did. Okay. I don't think that was part of what we were looking at. We were looking at the application of the code to new development, not to old. And the nonconforming provisions as it relates to MDT, those specifically may need to be more addressed as to how do you deal with nonconformities. I would suggest to you, unless Mr. Molman is going to correct me, the expansion of a building that does not comply with the UDO or does not comply with the MDT requirements is going to have to seek a Board of Adjustment variance if it's going to proceed forward. The intent of the UDO, and this is a question that has come up, you have a 25% expansion, and the question that specifically came up and has been addressed, which prompted me to go back into the nonconforming section, is what do you do about buildings that go beyond the 25%. Currently, anything that is nonconforming has to seek an authorization for a permit from the board to begin with. Anything over 25% goes in a variance criteria. Okay. So, and I can speak to two projects that we have recently taken through that had expansions that were less than 25%, were in the MDT, and were construction that was not two-story. We have the Jiffy Lube that is down on Providence that was looking at adding about 100 square feet onto its showroom or its seating area as a single-story construction. Two things had to happen at the board. One, the board had to authorize the construction of the 100 square feet and grant the height variance, or not the height variance, but the exception to the two-story requirement of the MDT based upon the scale of it. And that was, a minimal expansion of their footprint, but it still got the board authorization and permit approval. Staff, it is a protective facet of the way that the code is set up. The administrative authority, it shields us from criticism as it relates to granting permits for buildings that are non-conforming. We require the board to issue that permit and basically place that burden on the board to review the evidence and then basically make that decision. The second project that was in a similar situation was Lifestyle Furniture. If any of you have driven out on Broadway, you will notice that there is a new addition that took a portion of their parking lot that I believe is for furniture storage as part of their showroom space. They were probably storing more furniture out on their showroom floor. That was another project, non-conforming. Had to get a permit to do an expansion. It is also in the MDT, and it would have been required to have had two-story construction.
Okay, let me pop back to residential for just a moment. Referring back to the west side, we've got a lot of non-conforming lots, oddballs, you know, under 60 feet, well under 5,060. And we face a demolition crisis, and we face a affordable housing crisis. I'm trying to avoid getting in a situation whereby any upgrades, code bringing up to isn't viable. You understand what I'm saying? And we end up, what's happening is we're getting this cascading demolition thing going. Mm-hmm. And most of them are non-conforming. The three current ones are, well, at least two of them are non-conforming lots. And for the person who might own one or two rental properties, doesn't want to go through the Board of Adjustment dance. I'm trying to think of how to keep some of this housing stock without them hitting some threshold. And you guys are like, look, there's nothing we can do. It's got to come down, or it can't be reoccupied.
And I think what we
which
have
is a daily. Mr. Teddy's shaking his head. This is a daily thing. We run into this.
And I think the way that we would probably want to approach this again is, we have to have better information as to where we believe that these lots will exist and in what zoning district. And I think what you look at is if a zoning district potentially allows a mixture of uses, and that mixture of uses, let's just say it's an MN,
okay,
what will be future neighborhood commercial or a replacement to our C1, in that district we do allow residential development. So if you take a non-conforming MN lot and you want to, albeit residential may not be the objectionable use, mm-hmm, it may be the fact that you could put a commercial use on that, and carving out or creating any additional waivers from having to meet the standard regulatory process may end up unintentionally creating a greater impact to that property because of the district's spectrum of uses. In a residential setting, it is possible that you could carve out an exception as it relates to particular site aspects, possibly access. We may be able to have something that can deal with how do you obtain access if it's a legal substandard lot. But we have to look at what is the particular unique zoning district that may be in and what's the collection of uses that are allowed in it, because the way that the provision is written, you can use that non-conforming lot for any permissible use in the district. Well, when you say any, that's pretty broad in certain zoning districts, and that is where the safety valve, if you've got to go through the board, you may not be able to get that real objectionable use that's allowed because you can't meet the other standards. whereas a use that may be more in keeping can happen because you could.
I'm with you there. I'm just trying to avoid the, as I said, the cascading effect of what kind of what haven't we thought of, and at the same time, developers are tearing, I mean, home property owners are tearing these houses down, and we're losing housing stock, and we need housing stock. It's just this great, you know, we are going in opposite directions here. And a lot of them are nonconforming. This needs more research and more understanding, because these are almost all a case-by-case basis, because some of that's what I'm talking about. Some of it's one, most of it's two, and there's some three.
I think the code is drafted. The proposed code in the nonconforming lots section creates an opportunity to reutilize small lots with new construction. And I think that may be part of the problem is when, and under the current code, where you have a substandard lot that is too small in area and in frontage, there's nothing you can really do with it except for demolish and then combine it with other lots for larger development. I think this creates an opportunity to use the substandard lot as it exists. I've kind of jokingly called this is the way we get the tiny houses.
I hope so, because that's which about some of these, that's all we could really do on them, unless they were replatted.
Yeah. So I think it's an increased opportunity for reuse of substandard lots.
Okay. All right. We need to visit this more in the future. That's what I have right now. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Any other questions or comments from commissioners? Before I open it to the public comment section part of it, I'd like to make a couple of quick reminders. When you come up and get to speak to us, please give us your name and address so that we can track that. And also, we are here for comments related to the UDO. So if there's anything outside of the UDO, we would hope we would have that at a later meeting. So with that, I'll open the public comment, and please come forward and give us your comments.
Hi, good evening. My name is Tim Wade, and I reside at 2104 Bluff Point Drive. I'm a non-resident homeowner of 1513 Bushell Avenue, which lies within the boundaries declared by the East Campus Neighborhood Association. I do have some media I'd like to load real quickly. I'm here tonight representing a petitioned majority of East Campus Neighborhood Association owners, parcel owners, in regards to the East Campus overlay as it pertains to the UDO draft being proposed right now. My purpose is threefold: to present documentation of illegal and unethical actions by the ECNA leadership on behalf of the city with regards to the overlay and the UDO, to summarize our East Campus majority members' fruitless efforts to engage both the ECNA leadership and the city's 6th Ward Council member, Betsy Peters, in participative representation with regards to that overlay and the UDO. And third, to present a petition along with its companion task force proposal that we've entitled East Campus Majority Task Force Overlay Proposal for the East Campus Urban Conservation District. So you're aware of this meeting we had on July 7th to summarize our concerns toward Ms. Peters regarding the East Campus Neighborhood Association's illegal and unethical efforts to preclude us from their process on this overlay. We met with Ms. Peters on July 18th to summarize some of those issues and hear her responses. At that meeting, we presented documentation of illegal meeting held May 26th by the East Campus Neighborhood Association. It basically states that advance notification was not given within the guidelines of the bylaws. Many members of the East Campus Neighborhood Association who are non-resident homeowners were not notified of the meeting, and it was publicly posted to a Google website the day before the meeting was held. Following the meeting, one of our non-resident land homeowners who was at the meeting asked the East Campus Neighborhood Association leader for a understanding of what had happened at the meeting in terms of who might have been appointed to a unknown task force, and this was the response that we get, that three landlords or have been appointed to the East Campus Overlay Revision as per the motion passed at the May 26th meeting. Okay. Now, what we essentially found from that meeting was that, you know, as we took our concerns to Ms. Peters, we sort of were looking for inclusion in the process and trying to insert ourselves into a participation. But she indicated that the secret, non-representative, unethical, illegal task force would continue without her intervention, and we were quite disappointed in that response, and many of us were quite insulted. In fact, at that meeting with Ms. Peters on July 18th, eight members of the original revision committee from 2000 through 2003 were at that meeting and had asked to be included and were turned away. Many of those committee members are here tonight and representing us. So we feel like we've taken the appropriate steps to engage ourselves in the process through the ECNA and through the Sixth Ward Council member, Betsy Peters. We've done things legally, ethically, and in good faith. We're proud of these efforts. Having been denied representative voices, we, the East Campus majority, submit this petition and its companion overlay proposal. This petition, signed by 212 parcel owners within the ECNA boundaries, states, we, the property owners in the East Campus neighborhood, reaffirm our support for the existing East Campus Urban Conservation District overlay and the democratic process of consensus between resident and non-resident property owners that created it. We strongly oppose any additional restrictive changes or property limitations to the current overlay dated March 17, 2003, Ordinance Number 17627. 212. This is an organic document. It's still growing. By our count, there are 393 parcels in the East Campus Neighborhood Association boundaries and only 108 resident-owned parcels. So we've created our own task force and created our own overlay revision. It's simply the current overlay, as per the petition suggests. And we have added some editing and comments, such as, you know, areas where new language would have to be updated if a potential UDO draft were brought in. We could simply put that language in. We were not afforded the luxury of city resources to integrate this document into the proposed UDO, so we don't know what that language is, but we would certainly entertain advances by the city if they would like to include themselves in our efforts. In summary, you know, this is basically a document that maintains the current overlay as it's been created. I would say that when we look at the history of the East Campus Neighborhood Association and the East Campus area, it should be noted that the East Campus was zoned R3 in 1953. That was 66 years ago. All of the current residents of the neighborhood were aware of that zoning when they purchased their homes. The city planners created the R3 zoning in 1953 in East Campus for a reason, to expand the qualities and the characteristics of the neighborhood to accommodate the lifestyles of both university students and established professionals, so they might enjoy living and learning and leisurely pursuits alongside one another. That was the city's vision in 1953. There are several false narratives regarding East Campus. These false narratives are generated by the minority and assumed by people who are new to Columbia, who are not familiar with the day-to-day realities of that neighborhood. One false narrative is that it is a problem neighborhood with problem tenants and problem absentee landlords. That condescending narrative is not only false, it is insulting. We owners have integrity and take pride in our housing and the care that we provide for our residents. This neighborhood has no more problems than any other neighborhood. It simply has a wider variety of problems due to its wider variation and owner and resident demographics. A second false narrative that is that this current overlay has serious problems and has harmed the character and quality of the neighborhood. That presumptuous narrative is not only false, it is elitist. The current overlay has improved the neighborhood and broadened the qualities and the characteristics of the neighborhood by providing guidelines on how the 1953 R3 zoning should evolve. The current overlay continues to reinforce that 1953 vision to accommodate the lifestyles of both university students and established professionals so they might enjoy living and learning and leisurely pursuit along one another. Any questions?
Commissioners, are there any questions for the speaker? Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Wade, I appreciate that you may be looking at your ordinance again, but tonight we're really taking comments on the UDO. So I guess I just wanted clarification if the majority task force considered any of the proposed UDO language to be creating more restrictive requirements for the conservation district.
We are not familiar with any UDO language that we would need to include in this current overlay as we have petitioned to maintain it.
I'm asking the reverse. Is there any UDO language that you consider to be making more restrictive requirements on you?
Not at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wade. Anyone else like to come up and speak?
Your name, Elizabeth.
Name and address.
2220 Shepherd. I think just to clarify on that, I think in the current UDO, there's just a heading. Am I correct, Mr.
Ma'am,
Zinner?
We missed your name.
Elizabeth Crawford.
Elizabeth Crawford. Thank you.
In the current UDO, there's just a heading that says East Campus Urban Conservation Overlay, and there's a blank. And so we don't know what's going to be in it. Is that correct?
What would have been in that section, or what is intended to be in that section, is the existing East Campus overlay with editing changes to ensure that its integration into the UDO had been made. That would be inclusive of making section reference changes that deal with particular elements that already exist. There would not have been any substantive text changes made to the existing provisions other than those necessary for integration. Initially, it was not intended that we were, initially, Clarion's effort was not inclusive of bringing in the overlays into the UDO. They were going to leave them as freestanding ordinances out as a separate document. As we moved through this process, we felt that if we were going to create a unified development document that included all of the requirements as it relates to property throughout the corporate limits, the actual overlay ordinances should be within the content of the UDO as they were actually written. Now, the Ben Stevens overlay, they had requested the opportunity to make changes to it. Those changes were submitted. They went through a formal process to submit those to us to incorporate into the UDO, and that is why they show up there, and that is why they are actually referenced as an amended version of their initial approving ordinance. We would have done the same, or will do the same, as it relates to any substantive revisions that may be being offered by either the majority property owners group or by a group that would have otherwise submitted us any revisions, the other group that you refer to. We have received nothing. We have received nothing to add, and we would, as part of the final public hearing draft, have included the existing ordinance approved with the minor changes that we needed to make. So if there is a document that you would like staff to look at and to potentially have contact with your group on, please submit the document to staff so we have an opportunity to be able to evaluate the document, make sure that the changes that you desire are compliant from a legal perspective, and then we will basically be able to put that out in a public form so those that are interested, not just those that live in East Campus, have an opportunity to look at what changes are being proposed.
And that's what we propose tonight.
But this is not the forum for that tonight.
It is not. We need the documents so we can do public notification properly to allow the public to have full open access to the documents that are being worked on. And that's part of what we're this is an opportunity for you to express that this is what you want to do. Now what we need is we need to see a document so we can produce something for another public session. And that's where we can have a more thorough debate amongst the sides, which we would prefer not to. That is why the way that your ordinance is structured is you're supposed to have a committee that works on it, and you bring to this body and ultimately to City Council a document that is generally agreed on. There's obviously going to be pieces that you won't agree on, and that's what the authority, the governing authority, City Council has to wrestle with at the end. But we need to go through a public process first to where everybody that may be interested in this document has the opportunity to see the changes that are being proposed.
I guess we're proposing the current overlay as it was written. The only changes that would need to be made to make it, as far as we know, we're not UDO, we're not Clarion or, you know, UDO writers, but in the event that you guys recommend or the council adopts the UDO, if that gets that far, that we recommend that the current overlay be inserted. The only differences should be updating the zoning from R3 to RMF or whatever. The changes would be so minor. They're so minor. But we would be happy to sit down with you or Pat or whoever knows how to write that.
It still needs to be submitted so that we can properly go through the process.
Okay, I guess our best effort was submitting the current overlay. Maybe that's.
And to that extent, Mr. Chairman, what I would suggest is if what this group is requesting is that the overlay, as it is written, with the technical changes that need to be made, be added. That would have been staff's intention, and that's what we would have done. Now, we will share that document with Mr. Wade to share with his group once we have made the technical changes necessary for compliance purposes.
That's what we're
asking. Anything beyond that will not be made without, as I have previously said, a formal public hearing document being submitted in advance and being able to be reviewed in a forum like this, because it will not be rolled into the final draft and only the final draft. If there are more substantive changes than the technical changes necessary, those will have to be handled as a separate hearing item.
The main concern that I guess one of the main concerns is we had been told that there was a task force working on rewriting this overlay. We have tried since May 20, whatever it was, 26th or what have you, to be included in that process, and we had been denied. And so we followed, if you read the current overlay, in the current overlay, there is the way that the overlay, everyone agreed in 2003 on how that overlay can be changed. And it says 50% of parcel owners need to want it. It's not exactly obviously that, but, and, or there needs to be a representative task force with equal number of non-residents and resident property owners. And we've asked to be involved in this process. We've been told we cannot be involved in this process and that the process will continue and that we won't know what's going to be in that secret proposal to you until it may be too late is what we were afraid of. And so, you know, we thought, you know what, let's follow the rules. Let's go with what was put in that current overlay that everyone agreed on and spent 2 years meeting and developing. And so that's why we said, you know what, we're not going to change it. Everyone agreed on this. Everyone agreed on how it gets changed. This is it. And so we didn't have any other options. We tried multiple avenues. We've tried the ECNA. We've tried, you know, going to council people. We've tried a lot of different things, and we didn't know what else to do. So we decided, you know what, we're coming here. Here it is. You guys, you know, the city staff or whoever can help us update it to the UDO, but that's our proposal. So.
I understand. Thank you. Is there any questions to this speaker? Thank you, Ms. Crawford. Next speaker, please.
Good evening. My name is Mark Farnan, 103 East Brandon Road, Columbia, Missouri. I want to thank you for your warm reception, even though we don't need any more heat compared to the outside temperature. This has been a good process. And I know this is number six of the big number of meetings that we've been having, but this has really gone pretty well, I think, so far. And you have accorded us the luxury of time and interaction. And thanks for doing that. I do think it's going well. I have found myself confused and ask for your help tonight. And partly that's because this deals with legalities and that kind of thing. So I may need to refer to you tonight for expertise. As I read through this part with the rules of conduct and of business and enforcement and that sort of thing, I have a tangential interest in what the previous speaker discussed. I looked through there and I could see where different bodies are accorded different powers, and some things have changed over time, and maybe something that used to go to Board of Adjustment now goes to planning and zoning and that sort of thing. And I too looked at the overlay part, and I saw the one from Benton Stevens and then didn't see the overlay from East Campus, and I too thought that that should be included in here somehow. And then I thought that I should also see the historic preservation overlay and the scenic road overlays. And then there was a line that directed me that way. And it said that if we wanted to see the language, or that if I wanted to see the language, if I wanted to see the part that deals with the Historic Preservation Commission, which this also dealt with powers of commissions, it also dealt with overlays, it dealt with all this stuff. If I wanted to see what were the powers of the Historic Preservation Commission, that I should go to section 20-5.1D. And when I went there, it said 29-5.1 Part D, the membership terms, powers, and duties of the Historic Preservation Commission are listed now in 29-2.3 Part C, Part 2 of the Historic Preservation Overlay District. So I went there. And it says nothing. Because footnote 5 on that same page says provisions for the historic preservation overlay have been deleted, since those were contingent on council establishing a historic preservation commission and procedures, which has not happened. Historic structure designation and protection should be conducted through that process, which was not done, according to the footnote, not through the UCO. Similarly, provisions for protection of scenic roads were not carried over because those can be protected through the SRO. So where is it? I can't find it in the code. And it refers me specifically to other parts of the code. And so I don't know what's in that anymore as it is being proposed to be changed. And this may be my inability to distinguish between a commission and an overlay, but the two seem to be intertwined to me. And specifically, I wanted to know if the powers of the commission, of the Historic Preservation Commission, were being amended the same way that the powers of the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Board of Adjustment were being amended, and that is this amendment that was applied to those two, that they shall adopt the rules for the conduct of their business that are consistent with the purposes of the commission and the requirements of this ordinance, which shall be approved by council ordinance. Current rule for the Historic Preservation Commission does not have that last phrase, which shall be approved by council ordinance, and they make their own rules. So So if they are a commission and a planning and zoning is being asked to comply with the new zoning change rule, which was intentional, and it applies to planning and zoning and Board of Adjustment, does it also apply to historic preservation? Because I think that would be consistent and fair. But I can't find it.
And you want me to respond? I mean,
if you have that information, yeah, well, if you don't, then we can.
And if I can understand what Mr. Farnan is referring to, in section 29-2.3, paragraph C, which is actually, or section C, which is the historic district, the historic preservation overlay district.
Right.
It talks about the purpose of those districts. And then it talks in paragraph 2 of that particular section, it talks about the Historic Preservation Commission and its makeup, its years, how they elect, their powers and their duties.
Is that the new one?
It should be in the May 2016 draft.
I got it from the May 2016 second line update piece.
Okay.
Website that says this is the special.
Oh, no, that would be the special. No. It would have been in the main body. The special supplement was for only the Ben Stevens overlay. That was the special update. That's probably why you're confused.
Well, there you go. That's so, you're getting there.
Okay, yeah. And that is the special supplement was just their overlay because it came in after we had released the main chapter. So if you look at the main chapter of what was covered for that May 19 meeting.
Instead of the thing that says the update addition to, I thought that replaced what, okay.
I will go back and I will make sure that we have the website more clearly defining that.
Well, that'd be good, but so I get it. So then this will be easy. You will be able to look this right up. Does it have the rule that was applied to the Planning and Zoning Commission and to the Board of Adjustment that says in its responsibilities and in its powers, adopt rules for the conduct of its business that are consistent with the purposes of the commission and the requirements of this ordinance, which shall be approved by council ordinance? Because in the old one, it doesn't say it that way. It says they can adopt their own bylaws and procedural regulations, provided that such regulations are consistent with this chapter, other ordinances of the city, and the revised statutes of the state of Missouri. The revised statutes of the state of Missouri clause in the original code has been replaced by approved by council. So I think we ought to do that to the Historic Preservation Commission if we're going to do it to this body. Because these are the three bodies that have a D anywhere in the chart that says the decision making, and they decide on certificate of appropriateness.
I'm going to read to you what section 3, item I, reads,
okay.
And just follow along with what you just read for the Planning Commission.
Gotcha.
It begins, the Historic Preservation Commission shall have the following powers and duties, : item number 1, to adopt its own bylaws and procedural regulations, provided that such regulations are consistent with this code, other codes, other ordinances of the city, and state law.
And shouldn't it then put the phrase in, which was intentional, that was applied to planning and zoning and to the Board of Adjustment, which also says, which shall be approved by council ordinance?
I can address that. I was responsible for that particular amendment and not adding that to the historic preservation bylaws provision as an oversight.
Okay.
The intention is to have that consistent, I think that's something that we're going to have to take up as to whether or not that is something, whether we're going to require or not. But for each of those decision-making bodies, it should be consistent.
And I know I got pretty far in the weeds there, but I thought I had to. Okay, thanks. Here are a couple of more. I think that the rule, and I'd like to go on record, that has been significantly reduced. The subdivision plat, preliminary plat that expires after 3 years instead of 7 years is too, I think that's not enough. The rationale that I have heard from people about why we would do that is so that we can accommodate change as it occurs. When somebody first gets a preliminary plat and then it starts to do something, then we change. I think that is dealt with in a different part of that where it says each final plat for land included in the preliminary plat application shall comply with any new technical or engineering standards, et cetera. So you've covered yourself there and wouldn't need, for that reason, you wouldn't need to reduce the time frame from 7 to 3. But then tonight, I believe that it was the phrase was something like, we're trying to protect against people biting off more than they can chew. The problem is that there's no, the additional restriction doesn't give any concomitant benefit to someone who does put things at risk. And it's not just a builder or somebody who wants to subdivide a piece of land, it's also lenders who are put into an odd place when they don't have an assurance that all of a project will be, with when they don't have assurance that they would have the time to be able to build out a project to get to the place where they make a profit on a subdivision, which usually comes at the last 20% of the build out. I think 7 years is a reasonable amount of time. I think 3 is not. There was no financial impact study done on this part, and I can't tell you what the differential in cost would be between a 3-year and a 7-year idea, but I can tell you it won't be cheaper because you have to go through a lot more hurdles, additional representations, possibly a different additional engineering, and some additional requirements for replatting. Some you'd have to do anyway just to keep up with current code. But the artificial expiration of it, particularly when it says if you do not submit a final plat for any portion of it, not just that you started on most of it, that doesn't count. If you don't submit a final plat for any portion of that, the whole thing is invalid. I also, it's not clear to me in the language, if someone has already been granted a preliminary plat prior to the time of the enactment of the new code, whenever that may be, if it's a 4-year-old preliminary plat, is it automatically invalidated or is it grandfathered? Because I didn't see that in the discussion of nonconforming tonight. And so I have that question, and it's probably something that ought to be debated. I don't like that rule, and I want to go on record as that. I also wonder about there has been discussion about the interpretation of the powers of the boards and how you may assign those powers to different groups, whether it's administrative, whether it's this decision-making or recommending body. And that how state law applies to the powers of commissions and how those shall be reviewed. And I know that city staff has provided at least one interpretation of that. I know that there are some people who believe there's a competing interpretation of state law. I would hope that before we pass this, based on one or the other, that we get a pretty ironclad decision on what is it, does it say, and how does that affect what we will do in a new code. And I would encourage that, and I think that should be done before the issuance of a public document that is based partially on that interpretation that is disputable at this time. I'd also like to see that manual, and I know that you have addressed that tonight, the administrative manual, what's in that. Everybody wants to see it, and I'm sure it will give us 300 more pages of enjoyable reading. I had one other thing that I would like to bring up. And thank you for the clarification on that other part that I could not find. I can't find it. That's all right. I'll send it to you. Sorry, I can't find it tonight. That's the majority of what I had to talk about. Thank you for your time. I'm sorry I went just a little bit longer than I typically do. This looks like John Clark's notes, but they're mine. I did not copy them. That show's on a different channel tonight.
Is there,
so thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions or clarify why I asked what I asked.
Are there any questions? Mrs. Burns.
I just want to say thank you for being our constant companion in this, Mr. Farnan. You continue to raise issues that we need to think about. And I think you've raised some important ones tonight as far as commission responsibilities and who does what when. And I appreciate it because it's making me think about what my responsibility on planning and zoning is and how it relates to other commissions. Other commissions should be thinking about that too.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate that comment. And it's a long old slug, and you guys do it too. So
I don't know.
That. The club.
Oh, I don't, Mr. Farnan, don't leave just yet.
Yes, sir.
We're not done with you.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. McMahon.
Good evening, Mr. Farnan. How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
Outstanding. I wanted to return to your expiration concerns.
Yes.
Okay. You described the 3-year as artificial, which implies the 7-year is not. Let's move to the bank piece, the banking piece, the financial piece.
Right.
While 7 years is certainly more fluid, 3 years is certainly more sure, is it not?
More sure?
In the planning phase. You come to a banker and you got to pitch your concept.
Yes.
They got to like that, don't they?
7 years is just as sure as 3 because it's a defined number.
Okay, so.
I mean, if we go to the bank
mm-hmm.
and we say we have, and I think that the example that was used tonight was what if you do 100 acres? In a subdivision, a lot of people do that, and they do it in phases, or they'll come in with a plat or a preliminary plat, mm-hmm. and then they expect to be able to accomplish that over time. There are some people who can't even get the whole thing going after the issuance and the guarantee of a preliminary plat for 2 years. If you expect that then to be completed and done and completely envisioned within 3 and no part thereof can be exempted from that and it expires, what is the benefit? What's the benefit to that except uncertainty and additional cost? So if you leave it at 7 years, no harm, no foul, because the people who will be coming in, even if the rules change during that time that are passed by the council or the building codes change,
they have to do that anyway.
Have to do it anyway in part 3 of that same section.
All right. Would there,
against it.
All right, let me redirect a little bit. Would a midpoint maybe address some of staff's concerns? And is 5 years enough?
I talked to some people about that, and there are some rules of some things that do go at about 5 years, but we didn't see the rationale for the reduction at all, and so it's hard to say that there ought to be a compromise on a piece where the rationale to us was not clear at all. Because we think it's already dealt with in another part. So I'll stick with 7. But would 5 work? It'd be better than 3, I guarantee you. And the lenders who take a lot of the risk in this, they're 80% out because you don't make your money back till the last 20 on so many of these deals. I would think it would give greater comfort to people throughout this town about the investments that are made and that are reasonable and well-planned developments. So I'm looking for that. I'm looking for the rule the way that it is now, and I don't see the reason to change it. If it goes to 6, I think it's arbitrary any way you do it. Somebody picked 7 out of a hat. Somebody picked 3.
Well, I'm going to follow Ms. Burns here, and I'm going to thank you for encouraging me. I have coffee with bankers every morning, and we're going to talk about this very thing.
Yeah, good.
And I really do appreciate you.
Think it's an important one to talk about, and it. Yeah, I'm taking a contrary position, something that was recommended at different times. That's okay.
I do appreciate it, Mr.
Thank
Farnan. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? I see none. Mr. Farnan, as always, we do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Pat?
Before Mr. Farnan leaves, let me respond to something, and I will apologize to the public as well as for the public record. The provision that Mr. Farnan refers to, which is all within the same section, obviously, and you would have had to have turned the page, in order, as Mr. Farnan has, because he's very thorough in his analyses of this code.
I copied and pasted it. And yes. Then, yes.
So he has clearly identified the fact that, yes, item number three, which is corresponding to this three-year reduction, any subsequent phase, if you have a multi-phase project and you only seek to get one phase approved and those construction plans are approved under one set of regulations, the subsequent phases are going to have to meet the regulatory requirements at the time that that final is submitted. So that is what item number three says, and that is correct. We've triggered everything, we've rolled everything from 7 to 3 years. What I misspoke is that that preliminary plat approval goes away if you haven't recorded everything within 3 years. That is not factual. What is factual is the fact that if a subdivider does not submit a final plat, i.e. meaning he does not submit a final plat within that three-year period, the preliminary plat is void. I know this for a fact because I insisted that the provision be added. Because what we have is we have projects that wait, record one final plat, and then without the prior provision of needing to upgrade to the right regulatory standards, that property may sit for 10 years before the second phase is developed. And it may take them 5 years to develop that property because the market fell apart. They lost right. their financing. There is no purpose in our mind that if you're trying for such a big project that you can't even get it put together to do a small piece of it within 3 years, that the 7 or the 3 is an arbitrary number, yes, but at 3 years, there's a whole lot less in our mind issue with a project that may or may not ever occur, going away and having to start all over again. So if you record a plat within that 3 years, that preliminary plat's design, its original layout, all of that's going to stay in place throughout the rest of the development. And I remember Mr. Molman explaining this to help me understand, to some extent, that idea. We may change our regulatory standards. We may change the pavement width. Our right-of-way width, we may require 50 feet today, and in 3 years we may say, no, we want 25-foot wide roads. Well, if that developer's already gone out and done his design engineering for a 50-foot wide road, we're not going to tell him, we're not going to take your 50-foot wide road. It was on the approved preliminary plat.
Right.
But that 50-foot wide road is going to be designed to the standards that exist at the time that he comes in with that phase. So the design element of what he's gotten his approval on, what he may have gone to the bank to get approved, is protected in the preliminary plat sense.
For 3 years?
No. After you've recorded. If you fail to record anything, you lose it. If you record, you do have the plat being maintained. The preliminary plat is maintained. You're not being locked into the design specifics. And that's what the prior section reads, and that's the clarification that's made. As I had indicated, there's always been a confusion as to, well, do I get to develop my project that I got approved 10 years ago, even though I recorded a phase under the old design standards? No. That's what the first provision corrects. You're always going to develop your next phase under the then-existing design requirements. Your preliminary plat, however, expires if you've done nothing with it for 3 years.
Or any portion thereof.
Yeah, you can always record either a part or the whole. So if you record a phase, which would be a portion, the rest of that preliminary plat is secure, as long as you're meeting with each subsequent submission the design requirements that exist.
I don't think that's what this says.
That is what it is intended. We do not, there is no way, reasonably, I believe, that you can expect large acreage tracts that come in that want to do comprehensive land planning up front.
Right.
To be able to be built out within a three-year period of time. You can't expect them to be built out within a seven-year period of time. I will point to Phillips Farm. It was approved in 2004, and where are we now? Mm-hmm. It's still not developed, and they're still changing it. At least as they're changing it, we're going through a formal process of change, and we're requiring that they meet the current design standards. What this basically is saying is if you've got your preliminary plat approved and you designed it, you're good. your road layout, your network, your street alignment, your lots, all of that's going to stay. But your design requirements that are required for the technical standards are those things that have to be kept current.
Right. But, okay, let me...
Now, this may need a clarification, Mr. Farnan, and that's fine. I'm more than happy to do that. But I know for a fact what we were trying to avoid here was projects that just came in, and because it had 7 years, the neighbors who fought to not have that development occur or were selling their properties because they were afraid of an impact, and this project doesn't exist 7 years after that occurred, they've been negatively impacted. And part of it was we wanted to reduce the amount, intrinsically, we wanted to reduce the size of development proposals to something that was more meaningful.
But why does that come within the purview of the zoning code?
It's from a management and a maintenance perspective is what part of that is driven by. As the infrastructure systems, if you decide that you want to record a final plat, we don't tell you that you have to start at the very beginning. We don't tell you you have to start at the street. You could start all the way in the back of a 200-acre tract of land and have public infrastructure running all the way back to that parcel that never gets developed.
Right.
We wanted development to occur in a more logical and incremental process. If you're ready to go to town and you know you've got a market to meet it, go ahead.
But that infrastructure, for the most part, is paid for by the people who do the subdivision.
And then we maintain it. And that is part of what the concern has been. And we are trying to ensure that there's a balance between what we as a municipality have to receive after the developer is done and long-term maintenance costs associated with that and how quickly development is actually being brought into the system so it is more incremental. There may be a revision here that may be needed for clarity purposes,
okay.
But what I can tell you is your assessment of what the first clause is yes, we are protected because we will always have current design requirements being implemented.
Right.
The other is if you do not record anything, the preliminary plat approval that you've got, because we may have in 3 years changed our subdivision regulations, you no longer get to rely on. And you have to come back and plat.
I think it says that if you does not obtain a final plat for any portion of, does that mean this? Does it mean I can just do a little bit of it and I'm okay?
Or
does it mean
phase.
If I have omitted anything, I don't get any of it?
No, if you record a phase, a small portion of that larger tract of land, that is what any portion. We don't refer to it as a phase. We could have referred to it as a phase. And I mean, if you refer to it as a phase, it may be more clear, but I don't know. It's any portion. So, I mean, you have a 50-acre tract of land, and you only plat 10 acres of it because that you only wanted to put 10 lots on it.
Okay. How about this?
Okay.
How about this part? What if we didn't say it in the negative? Maybe I could understand it better. It says, if the subdivider does not submit a final plat for any portion thereof, what if you said, if a subdivider does submit a final plat for any part of it, they're cool.
Thank you, Mark.
That's captured in the minutes. We will take that under advisement, Mr.
Farnan. All right,
Farnan.
Thank you. All right, thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Farnan. We're definitely going to spend a lot of time on this topic, so thank you.
Caleb Colbert, 601 East Broadway. I just had a couple questions for Pat. I'm going to keep picking on him while he's on the hot seat.
So it's not about MDT tonight, is it, Caleb?
Oh, it is.
Oh.
So going back to the Jiffy Lube project. So if the UDO was in effect, would they then, would that expansion trigger a requirement to build street walls, comply with the private open area?
As it's currently written, I would tell you, yes. As it may be rewritten, no. That is an item that we will be taking up.
Okay.
I think the improvement, and this deals with other related requirements as well as to the nonconforming features of a site and tying them back to the scale of the reconstruction or the improvement. I think you have to look at it from that respect. If you had to go to the board anyways, though, and you knew that that would become an issue, what we would likely advise the applicant as to what are all of my issues I'm going to have to deal with. We're going to probably tell you up front, you need to not only deal with the issue of getting permission to expand the nonconformity, you're going to need to ask for the variance from the street walls based on the fact that what's being created probably doesn't justify it, if that provision existed. And I can't tell you right now that it will, ultimately. I mean, the open space issue is out on the table at this point. The street walls is out on the table, I would suggest, as well, to potentially either make it into the final document or be modified accordingly. I will tell you it will not exist in its current format.
Gotcha. Well, it just seems to me like that has the potential to, if you have to bring everything into compliance, I think that creates the potential for sort of freezing some of those small expansions. So there should be.
And I would suggest, as I think was offered at the June 23rd meeting when we were talking about MDT, as you relate to small area lots and exceptions specifically to small area lots, there may need to be threshold criteria associated with those types of minor incremental improvements that may or may not trigger a particular element that's not within the UDO at this point that basically takes us to a juncture. I will state that in answering questions from that June 23rd meeting, though, as we were going through the issue spreadsheet, and the idea of creating and carving out special exceptions beyond what already exists within the code has a tendency to potentially, you know, it's death by a thousand cuts. If we ever want to achieve the objectives of the general code and what it's trying to achieve within the MDT, to continue to whittle away at granting exceptions for things that just don't seem to be appropriate by right, not going through the board, who should be looking at things hopefully from a much more global perspective, may not be the appropriate direction either. And I think we have to come to understand what a reasonable compromise may be as to what triggers, what should trigger, what shouldn't trigger. The other thing is, as well, you may have an opportunity, and we may look at what the minor modification process is to allow for that to be incorporated there as well as an administrative relief, possibly, when it's of a certain size or certain impact.
Gotcha. And just to be clear, I mean, none of the – no strictly interior redevelopment, remodeling, would trigger any obligation in the MDT district to bring that site into compliance.
The only thing, as was discussed at the June 23rd meeting again, and it was the Niedermeyer building was used as the example, an interior renovation generally will not. We have to, however, look at what that interior renovation is proposing. If you're adding additional bedrooms, for example, you may have to have parking. The code does provide for parking to be off-site. So if you can accommodate whatever your impact is in another manner that doesn't affect the property, no, you will not have any impact on that site as a result of your interior renovation. But as soon as you have to put parking on your site because you can't find it, that changes the game.
Gotcha. Jumping topics now. On the losing your grandfathered rights for nonconforming use after discontinuing use for 6 months, personally, I would recommend that that be changed back to 12 months. Sort of using the restaurant example in industrial districts, in the M1 district. I could see where it'd be difficult to, if a tenant vacates a property, to find a new tenant, remodel the building, and bring that, you know, into compliance within that 6 month time period. I think a year is easier to make that happen. I think 6 months is just kind of cutting it pretty close. So my recommendation would be to move that to back to the 12 months. That's all I've got for tonight.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Colbert. Running out of time, so if we could shorten it up and let the others that happens.
So if I have a petition.
You need to please take
Tim
your
Wade,
name.
2104 Bluff Point Drive. If I have a petition in support of the current overlay, I don't have a document to present, but I do have a petition. Shall I present that petition to Mr. Zinner?
That would be appropriate.
Yes.
That included in the record then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on up.
John Clark, 403 North 9th Street. Actually, number three on my list was to ask, so what does this majority group have to do? Make an appointment and bring what that's taken care of. The second thing is, I have this old tachistoscopic equipment, you know, for speed reading. You remember that stuff? You broaden all your stuff. It's in my basement. Maybe for these 300-page things, and so I'm going to get it out and offer courses. Let me know if it would introduce you. The third thing is just to make sure. I have a lot that is 35 feet wide and 100 feet deep. That's less than 5,000, has less than 60. And so if I understand, and I have no idea, because I measured that repeatedly, but I've never measured just how far the front porch is from this. So those other kind of considerations that you're mentioning, that if it qualified under the less than 5,000, less than 60, it would probably be okay, not replat, not rezone, but as long as I could meet several other kind of requirements. And though, if I got that right, well, I'll have to come and talk to you in the eventuality about what those are. Actually, I want to stand. I thank you for your explanation about the 7 years and the 3 years. I stand, and I think that's great. I consider the 7 years speculative, and I don't think speculation goes with the word development. I understand some of the things that Mark was talking about, and so one of my questions was addressing the very issue about, well, we've got this thing and something, and it's 20 years later. Now, we have the same kind of thing in zonings, and I believe there's some changes in the UDO to address those things. I don't remember exactly what they are yet. But that idea of stale zonings, this sounds like that. So I'm going to introduce you to this really great term, the part of law school that I really loved. It's called Article 3, case or controversy. The federal judiciary. You don't get into court unless somebody's hurt or it really matters. If it does, if you aren't hurt, if you aren't damaged, if it really doesn't matter, it's too soon. Now, that was not just, that was back in 1787. In the state courts, they can do declarative judgments, say, well, what if we did this? What would, well, that uses up all the resources. So I see, and I really applaud the department's case or controversy rationale. We want to basically be looking at projects that are going to get done, not where we're trying to do something so we can go and bank, so we can raise all these kind of things. They have to be reasonable, and they have to be soon. And I, subject to somebody really presenting a lot, and I used to work for land developers. If you basically, if I understand this, it says, don't come in and apply for your preliminary plat unless you can imagine, based on that, doing something and bringing it to a final plat stage within 3 years. Now, I must admit, if it's something like it could be 10 square feet, I mean, I can see that going wrong. But the idea is that idea about orderly progression, this is really stuff I saw and watched too many speculative zonings where people were coming, and they never happened because they ended up not without finding. Well, this is a different thing, but that case or controversy standard, it's a real project. And so it really, to me, says you talk to the developers, and actually the bankers will listen when they come, when they somebody goes to them and said, we want to do this, and say, so what we really want to make sure that your plans are well enough along that when you apply for the preliminary plat, you can reasonably expect to be applying for a final plat on that and then moving on to the project for a meaningful portion of this project. I think these are wonderful standards to put out there to help guide the entire orderly development process, not just to make your lives easier, but make all of our lives better. Does that case or controversy analogy make any sense to you? Good. That being the case, thank you again. It was a good evening tonight.
Any questions for the speaker? Thank you, Mr. Clark. Don't be shy. Come on up if you want to speak.
No.
Anyone else? We always enjoy Mr. Clark. Anyone else? I see no one, so we'll close the
public comment portion of our meeting. Comments from staff.
Okay. Are any comments from the public that you'd like to ask?
Comments from the public? I think. I see none, so we'll go comments for staff. I was guessing ahead.
So, all right. Your next meeting, given what we have heard this evening and what we have had presented by Mr. Wade and the majority group, we will follow through with what we have originally discussed. We do not have any business items at this point as of today for the August 4th agenda. So we will be canceling the regular public hearing session of the Planning Commission's meeting. Meaning the 7 p.m. meeting will not occur. However, we will be having a work session at 5:30 on that day, and that work session may run late if the commission desires to do so to get some additional work done, but we will advertise it for 5:30. You will have a standard work session meal, and we will discuss the UDO comments spreadsheet. Continue that conversation from the prior week, which is when you have your next meeting, which is July 27. Your next regularly scheduled Planning Commission meeting, then, is the 18th of August. That meeting will start at 7 p.m. So it's our regular meeting time. Work session will be at 5:30 as usual, though. So regular public hearing will be August 18th. Any items that are received, and we have a number of them that are on the agenda. However, should we receive any type of additional information as it relates to East Campus from the other group, it would be included as a supplemental item onto this agenda. It will be out of our application cycle, but it will be advertised, and it will be made publicly available in accordance to our advertising procedures that we have for the 18th agenda. We'll have to follow up or see if we receive anything. If we do not, and it shows up at an agenda, we are not prepared. It is not an agenda item. And we can discuss that further in work session. But what I will tell you is if there is anything received between now and our filing deadlines or our posting deadlines for the Planning Commission's packet and the legal advertising requirements for any public hearing item on that agenda, that item would be included. And the public would be made aware of that through our agenda and the notices that we publish for the agenda items. I will tell you that the neighbors that are not being included, while we will publicly advertise it, if they're not being included, we do have the petition, and we may be able to reach out to the organizer, Mr. Wade, and have him contact his folks so they can assemble here to make comment if it is published. Up until that point, I really have my hands tied. I don't know what to expect, and I don't know when I'll expect it, but I guarantee you it will not be on an agenda just dropped in without being first advertised according to our procedure. It would be no different than advertising for these amendments that we have just completed. So that just as a purpose of clarification. You've got a laundry list of items here. This is your August 18th agenda. It's like they've all been pent up, and now they decide to come out of the woodwork for us. It is a lot of subdivision-related material. A lot of this is final plats. A lot of it is very minor final plats. I will tell you that the Creek Ridge project here is one that may or may not remain on the agenda. We are not sure yet. There are still some staff-related issues that we are trying to work through with the developer. The Kitty Hawk project, which we tabled this evening, will be on this agenda as well. So it is the late addition to the subdivisions. And then you have three public hearings. And these public hearings, as you can see, all have a development plan associated with them. So these should be a little bit more meaty. There are going to be combinations of the Mickle subdivision, which you will notice here is 140, and Mickle subdivision rezoning OP plan. This is for True Media, and that is the lot that is behind the True Media building that is on the business loop. There's a rezoning and then an OP plan for the parking lot that is to the south of Orange Street right now. Those will be combined under a combination subdivision public hearing item. Center State Apartments, this is a property that is up behind the Menards, across Vandiver, backing up to some residential neighborhoods to the north. This is a CP plan and then an accompanying preliminary plat to go along with it. And then ACCOP, this is American Campus Communities Youth Center. There is a major amendment that is proposed to the plan. It is not structural in nature. It has to deal with signage because there were no sign provisions beyond what the current residential requirements afford the property at the time that it was approved. So whenever we add signage to a planned district site, it is a major amendment. But it is not a structural modification to the site. So just to make sure everybody is not fearful that they're looking at building another building. Your properties that exist here are the Kitty Hawk, which we just tabled this evening, Mickle for the subdivision plat. Again, True Media is here on the northern portion of this lot, and this is the current surface parking lot serving the True Media site.
Bank building.
You have the preliminary plat for Creeks Ridge, again off of Old Plank Road. The Hendron Hills subdivision, this is a simple division of this A1 zone property in order to separate the existing single-family home from the larger undeveloped portion for establishment of an agricultural use. That has been tabled a number of times. We are finally being able to resolve those matters. Mattingly subdivision, this is a simple subdivision plat in order to divide up the property, if I recall correctly. And then the Bellows subdivision, again, this is a combination plat, if I recall, in order to be able to bring the two properties and make it a legal lot. And then, of course, we've got Mickle for the rezoning side, same property boundary, and then the Center State Apartment project, which the Menards is sitting right here as this large block. And then the Red Roof building is, of course, our outdoor shop. And then we have the ACCOP development, which is just relating to the signage. It has nothing to do with any of the structural plans or structural improvements to be located on that site. That is what we have had for you for this evening. We will continue to update, as I had said in work session, the issue and comment worksheet, trying to incorporate all of the July 7 and July 21st comments into that. And we will be releasing that out as an addendum to you as the commission. And then publicly we'll be releasing the entire document in its form as it gets updated before the next meeting. That is all we have for this evening for you.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Comments from commissioners? None. We'll look forward to seeing everyone on July 27th, which is one of our supplemental UDO discussion sessions. Would anybody like to make a motion for adjournment?
I move to adjourn.
Ms. Burns, we appreciate that. Would you like a second?
I'll second.
Ms. Lowe, we definitely appreciate that. And with that, we're adjourned.